It's really exciting. I am really interested in the politics of this place because a lot of the people that I love live here. I know a lot about the issues in terms of what people really care about because my friends are trying to buy homes. My mom's retiring. So there's all these different things that I think are going on in people's lives that keep me wedded to Florida. And I just got married here. So I also feel like Florida is always going to be home. So I'm super, super excited.
You know, one of the things I noticed too is like having grown up in South Florida and then leaving from time to time and career takes you different places is in coming back and seeing it just changes so fast.
Yes, it changes very, very quickly. I was actually, when I was looking at my venue when I was getting married at Jungle Island, I was driving through downtown and I started realizing that gentrification was touching South Florida. And it's kind of, it's one thing when you see other cities that you live in, like I've been in New York and I've been in D.C., and those places change and you kind of think, okay, well, this is what gentrification looks like. When it's happening in your own backyard and when you see the elementary school that you went to surrounded by new condos, you're like, wait, this is completely different. So it's in some ways it's sad, but in some ways, of course, it's exciting to see the city kind of get the due that it needs. I think Miami's a beautiful, beautiful place. So it's exciting to see that people are investing here. I know when I left college and wanted to come back here, it didn't work out mainly because of the job situation. There were not that many jobs in South Florida when I wanted one. So to think that the state is now attracting people from other states to come here.
So as these politicians come down to South Florida, you know, how should they approach this region? The voters here, but I mean, it's different than you will find in most other parts of the state.
I think having really spent all my time in South Florida, you should approach these people knowing that they're very, very smart and that they're living with the issues that they're talking about. So when you're doing an interview about collective bargaining, you have to understand that you're dealing with people who might have had an illness where their union had to step up for them. You're dealing with teachers who had to make do and buy supplies. You're dealing with and had to buy supplies and kind of make their classroom a better place without having all the backing and support that they wish that they would have. You're also dealing with people who are very connected with other countries. So not only are you thinking about the fact that people want to make money to survive for their own families, a lot of people are sending money back. I'm Haitian and I grew up in a household where you were constantly talking about the cousin who you had to buy shoes for. You're sending money back for Haiti, for people schooling. People want to adopt a child in Haiti. So there's all this idea that people aren't just thinking about money for the then and the here and now. They're thinking about generationally, how does my family thrive in this situation?
You covered President Trump's campaign. You covered Bernie Sanders' campaign. What did the most memorable thing that you could take from your time in covering the campaigns in 2016?
The most memorable thing I can remember is the raw emotion of both candidates. I remember when I started covering Bernie Sanders, women and young girls were crying in the audience because they were so moved by what Bernie Sanders was saying to them. And he was saying something that he had been saying for a really long time, but he was saying the people see you, that you really do deserve to have health care, that you really do deserve to be able to go to college and then get a job. Kind of plain talking things that you think people understood, but they're things that Bernie Sanders was saying in a way with such raw passion that people were moved. I remember I covered Donald Trump the last week of the election, and we were going out to North Carolina to some really, really small town. And everyone was like, why is he going to this place? And we showed up and it was like 10,000 people standing in a field, kind of in the dark, waiting to hear Donald Trump's name and cheering his name. And it was the same kind of emotion. It was this idea that people were not just tied to the policies that were kind of vague still a week before the election, but that people were so tied to the personality of the man. Those two things I will never really forget.
So coming back to what you said a moment ago, is it now we're really more tied to personality? That we want to see somebody we think is more genuine, isn't just giving us sound bites, the typical politician?
I think you think about President Obama. I think a lot of people were tied to his personality. A lot of people thought of the idea of hope being not just his policies that were in some ways policies that the Clintons had also kind of championed, but they were also looking at him as a hope that this is an African-American man with this mixed race background, and people saw themselves in him in both races. So I think that we've had this idea of personalities for a while. But I think what we saw in Donald Trump and in Bernie Sanders was that people saw people that were also not as politician. They were not as polished. I would argue that President Trump was a very polished person. He was a very classy guy. He was someone who you felt like had thought really, really long and hard about all the things that he was saying. When it came to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, they were giving thought into their speeches. But I think that they were also they felt like they were talking off the cuff, that they were kind of being real with you. And I wrote a story about how Bernie Sanders, even though he was still delivering a stump speech and he would repeat the same jokes and kind of say the same lines, that it felt so much fresher than you would than a regular politician. So I kind of had this dichotomy of a speech for Bernie Sanders. Like, he's going to start off with a joke about climate change in China, and then he's going to go to this, and then he's going to go to that. But people kind of ate it up because it felt realer.
So we come into this gubernatorial race, and I'm wondering, how much do you think Trump is going to play in this race in Florida?
I think that Donald Trump is on the ballot in all 50 states. Even though he's not going to be physically on the ballot, I think the elephant in the room is going to be on the back of people's mind. Do you want someone that's in the party of Trump, which is what the Republican Party is now, or do you want someone that's going to fight Trump? And from what I can tell from these candidates, while they're obviously focused on themselves now because it's primaries and we're going to be talking to the Democratic gubernatorial candidates, at the end of this, they're kind of attacking Rick Scott, but they're also, through that vehicle, also attacking Donald Trump. So I think that that's going to be on the back of people's minds.
All right, so we look at Florida. It's been dominated by Republicans, both in the House and Senate, as well as the governor's house for a long time. But we keep hearing this thing about a blue wave this year. It's the midterms, and we tend to see voters go the other way in midterms. You have two Republicans and, you know, four Democrats that we're going to be talking to. Is there really a blue wave, or is it just what we expect in the midterms?
I'm not sure. I think that when you talk to people anecdotally, there feels like there's a blue wave because so many more people are dialed in. So many of my family members, some of whom didn't vote in a swing state, in an important state like Florida, that are now talking about James Comey's testimony and know exactly all the ins and outs of the latest political book. So there are people I think are more tuned in, but Florida is still, at least Florida in terms of state politics, is a solidly red place. So if someone is able to win, if the Democrat is able to win the governorship, that's going to be a big sign for 2020.
Let's look at some of the issues that are going to come up, that have come up. In this last legislature, we saw gun control take center stage, sadly because of the Parkland tragedy. But we saw this group of kids and their parents and supporters come to Tallahassee and really push lawmakers. And Governor Scott, who has tried to stay away from this issue and was a friend of the NRA, signed a law that now the NRA is suing against. But, you know, we think about gun control. How big a role do you think that's going to play? And how much more do you think you're going to see the NRA in this election?
I think gun control is going to be a huge issue, and I think it's going to be because of those students at Parkland. I used to debate at Fort Lauderdale High School, and I used to go to Stillman Douglas High School, and I remember just thinking as a kid, I can't imagine the voice that these kids have found and the power that they've been able to wield. These are kids that are obviously not playing around. These are kids who have experienced the terror of gun violence. And the fact that Rick Scott is listening to them tells me that, yes, he also might be moved, but that he also feels that there's probably a political shift tied to these kids, and he wants to be on the right side of that as well. Obviously, he's not running for re-election, but there's this idea that I think Republicans don't want to. They realize that I think they're going to have to approach this issue differently than they have in the past.
Another issue, of course, not one brought up by Republicans that much, but climate change and sea level rise. You know, it almost feels like it depends on not just the party, but the geographic region. I mean, people in South Florida and even Republicans down here understand that it's an issue and it's something that we're dealing with already, where a lot of Republicans further north, it's just not. And there was a controversy in past couple of years where Governor Scott and his cabinet wouldn't even mention the word climate change. But, you know, you could see Democrats bringing it up and then Republicans just trying not to talk about it. But is this an issue that will have any legs in this election?
I think it's going to probably be split geographically as it has been in the past. As someone who grew up in South Florida, not only do people talk about it from a kind of changing of the neighborhoods, but there's this idea that, at least anecdotally, and I know I've talked to some experts that say that the storms are getting stronger. So when you think about the fact that you're living in South Florida and you're having to kind of rebuild every single hurricane season, it's in the back of people's minds if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I lived through Hurricane Andrew, and that definitely changed my perspective on kind of what Mother Nature can do to a neighborhood. I'm thinking about Homestead, and even now when I drive through it, I have flashbacks to Hurricane Andrew. So I think that there's people that understand that, but up north, maybe, and I would say maybe because of the geographical differences, they don't think the same way. And also because it's tied to industries, right? Like the president has been talking about the fact that he hasn't, I guess, blatantly been saying that climate change is a terrible thing or a thing that's completely made up, even though there's some in the past he said that it was a hoax made up by the Chinese. But there's this idea that there's an industry, oil, energy, all this, there's money tied to kind of denying that climate change is happening. So that could factor into people's kind of thoughts of on that topic.
Let's talk about this fifth candidate who will not be at the debate that we're co-moderating, Jeff Green, the billionaire from Palm Beach County. What do we know about him? What do you know about him?
I know very little about him. What I do know is that he has a lot of money, and that money could mean that he could buy ads and that he could become very familiar with voters. But last I checked, at one point he was in, and we were just discussing this, that he was in an exploratory mode. I'm not sure what that means. I don't know if that means that he's going to become this dark horse that people are going to want to vote for later. I've covered two people that people thought were not going to be able to win, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Both of them did very well. So, I mean, in some ways, anything could happen.
We're talking with Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour and a Miami native, and she's going to be joining me. We are co-moderators at this year's Florida Freedom Forum for the gubernatorial Democratic primary. It's going to be a two-hour debate that starts at 7 o'clock. It's going to be held at the Miramar Cultural Center, and it will be streamed live at WLRN.org. You know, I want to come back to this question of the Trump White House and your experience in covering Trump and the fact that really he kind of just threw the book out and just did what he wanted to do, and it forced other politicians to have to play his game. Are we living in a new era of politics because of that?
Well, there are some experts that talk about this idea that Obama made way for Trump in that Obama was this young candidate who had not spent a whole bunch of time in the Senate, which was kind of the playbook back in the day, and that he was able to be successful. And then you have Donald Trump, who I call him the reality TV president, in that he was someone that even though everyone said, oh, he's not really known, he's not a very known, well-known politician, he had been in people's living rooms for years. So I think, and then he got away with so much stuff, right? Like, I won't list all the different scandals for all the people at home, but there's this idea that he's kind of Teflon. And it's because he's brash, and it's because his voters think of him as this guy that's a wild card. One of his supporters once told me that he voted for him because he had a hot hand, that he just kind of looked like he was the cooler one, the one that the media was paying attention to. So I think there are also people that want to be the hot hand. They want to be the voter, the politician that people are talking about. They want to be brash. They want to kind of go with their gut. They don't want to listen to political consultants. And for some people, that might work. But let's remember that Marco Rubio tried to attack the president and tried to talk about the size of his hands, and that went really badly for him. He's still a senator, but he definitely didn't become president.
You know, just before we finish up, you were in Montreal for the G7 summit. So we talk about Trump and the way that he, you know, basically runs his business. And tell us just briefly what happened up there.
Well, what happened was that on the American side, first, President Trump was late to almost every single meeting. There was reporting that he didn't really want to go to the G7 because he didn't really see that there was really a purpose for him there. He wanted to be preparing for his Singapore summit with the leader of North Korea. But when he got there, finally, an hour and two hours late, he had really tough, intense meetings with our allies. And these are mainly because he's had these aluminum and steel tariffs that on Canada and the European Union countries. And people were very angry at that. And for the most part, that really nothing was resolved. They were able to at least when he left at 10:30 on Saturday, which was earlier than the summit ended, they were able to at least say, okay, we're going to have a joint statement. And then by the time he was on the flight, he decided to say, actually, no, I don't have that support, because the Prime Minister of Canada came out and said, well, we're not going to be pushed around by the U.S. So what you really had was the U.S. backing out of its leadership role in the G7, and the president saying, I don't really have to deal with you people. I can go about this all on my own, and I can make kind of decisions the way I want to. And our allies are saying, hey, if you want to do that, we can also figure out a way to work without you.
Going into tonight's debate, what should the candidates be thinking about what they show the voters? These are three well-known people, and then you have Chris King, who's lagging behind in the votes, and then you have Philip Levine, who's from Miami Beach. But what should they be showing tonight? What do you expect is going to happen tonight?
That question makes me think of my mother, who's been working in public schools in Miami-Dade County for more than 30 years. She's someone who wants to hear that a politician cares about her, that a politician understands struggling with not without making as much money as you want to make, that you that person understands that there's a generational issue here in Miami-Dade County, that you're having people have kids and then having to move to other states to get jobs, which is what happened with my family, because I know my mom would love for me to be living in South Florida. So I think that if I'm a politician, if I was someone that was preparing, I would want to be focusing on why did I run, what makes me connect to voters in a very personal way. Of course, you're going to have a platform. But to be honest, a lot of these candidates, some of them at least, have very similar platforms. So it's really what's going to make you stand out is whether or not you can be genuine. And if you can, of course, answer our questions.
You have a former mayor of Miami Beach. You have Andrew Gillum, who's the mayor of Tallahassee, but he's from South Florida. And then Gwen Graham, who is a representative from South Florida, and of course the daughter of a well-known and beloved by a lot of people, former governor and senator. What do you think these candidates have to do to sell themselves? They already have these big names. And right now, according to the last poll, Philip Levine has the biggest lead. But I mean, you know, moving forward, I mean, with a couple of months left before the primaries, is it just attack the person in the lead or is it something else?
I think it's really about selling yourself to people who have a stake in South Florida, who care about South Florida. It's going to be about differentiating yourself from your candidates, but I don't think it's about attacking other people. I think it's going to be about, do people feel like you care about them? I go back to my mom because I think about her so much. She's someone who's worked in the public school for 30 plus years. She's part of a union. She's also someone who's raised kids here. She's also someone who had to see her daughter go to another state because the economy in Florida wasn't such that I could get a job here. So what you want is someone who's going to explain, look, I understand what your family's going through, and here's my plan for making your life better.
But do you think that they have to show more aggressiveness? The Democrats have to show more aggressiveness.
I think it doesn't have to be aggressive as much as it's you have to point out why you're the better person, of course. So if you're talking to someone or talking about an issue and you know that your opponent has a weakness or just has a different opinion than you, then you should really lay that out. So don't just say, at least if you're for the legalization of personal use of marijuana, remind everyone else that another candidate actually thinks it should just be for medical marijuana. If you have a idea for creating schools or creating a minimum wage, if you believe in a $15 minimum wage and someone else believes it should only be $13, and you should just point that out. I don't think that being Trump is going to help anyone other than Trump. We've seen other people try to be him and it hasn't worked out. You think about Roy Moore in Alabama. You think about Marco Rubio right here in Florida. Those people tried to kind of persevere and try to be kind of nasty to people and it didn't work out. So I think Donald Trump is still kind of being very successful in his brand of politics, but I don't think everyone can do that.